Jack Rice, kind enough to join us at the beginning of our show on a Monday to talk about the latest with the Chauvin trial. JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com, as well as also JackRice.net. I'll link to everything a little bit later on. Jack, thank you very much, as always.
Todd, great to be with you again.
Thank you, sir. Let's go, first of all, back to the rulings on Friday involving the moving of the trial. Now, you had said, I think quite appropriately last Monday, that where else are you really going to be able to have this trial, considering the concerns you're going to have, security? It's not something that's really can just be put in any county courthouse. The judge did rule that the trial will not be moved out of Minneapolis. The fact that I think at the time he had 11 jurors already selected, I think that weighed heavily on the decision to keep it here in Hennepin County.
Oh, yeah. I'm certainly no Nostradamus in this case, but I can tell you this. The fact that the judge didn't cease jury selection when he said he would contemplate this issue, when we saw that the defense filed this motion once the city council negotiated this agreement, paid out the $27 million, not over time, but in one lump sum, what it told me was the fact that they didn't cease jury selection. They continued with it anyway. The problem is every time you pick another juror here, the less likely it is that you're going to bother moving this trial in the first place. And you're absolutely right. The problem is where do you try this case? What is a place that's more secure than Hennepin County? Think of all the money, the resources, all of the other capability that they potentially have here. And there's nowhere in Minnesota you can go that they haven't seen this. You could be in Rock County. You're going to find it. You're going to be in Blue Earth. You're going to find it. You're going to be in Grand Rapids. You're going to find it. It's just how it is.
I think there was a little more of a surprise. I thought they might actually delay the trial a little bit. That decision as well not made. Talk a little bit about that. Was it just kind of one of those things that was, you know, it once again under the same pretense? I mean, we're going ahead with it, so let's go ahead with this.
Well, I think a big part of this was the money that was spent. And you have the resources in play. And the real question is, what does this do? If you delay a trial, how does this help anything? Do you have a better understanding? Does this increase the intensity of it? Does it decrease the intensity of it? Are we basically at a fever pitch now? We realize the entire nation is watching this trial. And they are, by the way. If we think about where we are and the number of jurors that have been chosen, and sort of the makeup of those jurors and what that may mean, I think realistically, perpetuating this and stretching it out even further starts to feel somewhat ridiculous. Again, we have made this comparison to OJ and what has happened there. This is not that in the sense of timing. That's a trial that went on for some 8 months. This is something that's much different. But nevertheless, we can see that they're just about done picking a jury. It's just over 2 weeks, and they should probably have that wrapped up by tomorrow. There might be a few extra motions that go in later in the week. We're scheduled to start this next Monday, and again, no delays.
Jack Rice, kind enough to join us once again. Jack, the other ruling that happened last Friday was involving an incident with George Floyd and the Minneapolis police from a year earlier. Now, the judge, I believe, and once again, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I appreciate when you do. The judge, I believe, said, basically, since the police officer in that case didn't murder George Floyd, I'm not going to allow you to necessarily bring that entire incident into play. But he did allow some evidence of potential drug use at that time to be introduced into the trial, something that was similar to, they say, certain elements of the incident that happened on 38th in Chicago. Now, I've seen some people list this as a loss for Chauvin's defense team, that they feel as if this is not going to be enough to give him a defense. What's your thoughts on the ruling of the past case being elements of that being welcomed into this trial?
Boy, this thing cuts both ways. I mean, if we think about this, and again, you and I have talked about this. This is sort of unique for me in the sense that I'm regularly walking into jury trials where it's the prosecution is laying out sort of this idea that the police are always the good guys. The police are never the bad guys. You should sort of defer to what the police do. They have a really hard, scary job, and it's just how things are. And so that's what I see every day. And so my knee-jerk reaction is like, it's not always true, because I can give you plenty of examples. And then what you have with this is you have the opposite, because now I have that person being defended. And so I have to turn around and say, wait a second, let's talk about the other officers in a case like this. But what this pretrial motion does is it opens it up just a little bit. It doesn't give the defense everything that they really wanted. And remember, what they're really trying to argue here, and what they're going to argue, this is the theory, is that essentially they didn't kill George Floyd. George Floyd killed George Floyd. And what they really wanted was to show the consistency and the comparison between that 2019 arrest when George Floyd was arrested with drugs in his car, ultimately chewed up drugs in his system, the claim that he had been shot in the past, the claim that he couldn't breathe, the claim that he was crying for his mom. All of these things are horrible. But if you start seeing them several times, the real question is it brings up a pattern, it brings up credibility, and it brings up a question of whether or not they should have actually responded in a different fashion. They didn't get all that. They only got a little smidgen of it. The problem for the prosecution, on the other hand, though, is that if you get references to drugs in the past, and what you also get is drugs in this case, and you will, because the medical exam, especially that first one, talks about fentanyl. It talks about methamphetamine in it. And if what you can do is come back and say, I had no idea what he was on. I had no idea what was going on in this case, because obviously the officers did not. And if you can get a jury to see that piece and to talk about this is one of the things that officers face when they walk into any circumstance, they don't know what people are going to do or how they're going to react, you could get a juror or jurors to buy into that premise, and they could take weird leaps, and they do. Mm-hmm. So it's not a win for everybody. It wasn't as much as the defense wanted, but they got a smidgen. The question is whether they can get a juror or jurors to follow them down that proverbial pike.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, so the argument they're going to be is that he didn't clearly the knee to the back of the neck didn't kill him. He died of a drug overdose, which just ironically happened at the same time what Derek Chauvin was doing. Isn't that kind of like trying to argue the shark didn't kill the guy? It was meth. You know, it was kind of, I mean, you're trying to thread a needle pretty thin here, aren't you?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, here is from the prosecution standpoint, this is what happens. Please bear with my terrible example. The idea of walking into a hospital where somebody is dying of cancer, right? And they could die at any time. And the thing is if I go in with a gun and shoot them, it's still murder. You see what I mean?
Yes.
The difference is it's not about whether or not they're dying. It's not about whether or not they have heart problems. It's not whether or not they're taking drugs or they're taking too many drugs or prescription drugs or anything else. The only question that really, truly, and honestly matters is that because of the behavior of one person, did that person's life cease sooner than it would have otherwise ceased? And I think that's where the prosecution has to really hammer that point, that it doesn't matter about any of these other issues. They're diversions. They're designed to do one thing, to get the jury to take their eye off the real ball, which is, or in this case, the real death, the real threat, and in this case, the real knee that killed George Floyd.
Which is going to be very difficult considering they're going to be showing a 9-minute video in that courtroom.
Over and over exactly. And over again. I can guarantee what will happen in this one is they will show that video probably first if they can get away with it. And then what they will do is they will certainly show it at least once, several times during the medical exams, certainly during the closings, and I can guarantee that when the jury is in deliberations, they're going to want to see that tape again. And I remember being on the defense team and being the lead defender when I had juries say, hey, can we look at that videotape again? And I'm just like, oh, God, no, not again. Because it's never a good thing when you have something like that. It's the most damning piece of evidence.
Jack Rice, kind enough once again to join us, jackricelaw.com. Now I want to get into the jury. Today, our 14th juror was picked. Now, initially, there were reports coming on out that the judge was only looking for 14 jurors. He let it be known on Friday that he was actually looking to get 15. They've gone home for the day, so they're going to be doing jury selection again tomorrow for that last alternate juror, or, you know, it might potentially alternate juror. But the reality is that it's 14. Where did that 14 number come from? Is that just a number that someone must have seized on in the media?
Well, you know, what's interesting is when they were originally talking about this, they were talking about 16. And then what I heard from some friends of mine was that the courthouse was pushing on Cahill to go with fewer alternates. And so they were pushing on him for fewer alternates, and I think he wanted more. He wanted those four alternates, and frankly, he should have. I think he's smart to go with more alternates rather than less. Because the problem that you have is, what happens if people blow apart? What happens if they do some strange thing? They talk to the public, they talk to the press, they don't show up for court, they do something stupid, they get arrested. Whatever it is they do, whatever could happen may happen. And you need to have people as backup. And while four people may seem like a lot, heck, two people may seem like a lot, this trial could go a month. It may go less. It may go more. You just never really know when things can happen in the middle of a trial. And because of that, you need to have backup just in case. Because if you don't, you run out of alternates, you have to start over, which means you have to start picking a jury over. You don't just get to reach back out and say, well, we're going to grab a few more people and just sort of squeeze them into the mix. You can't do that. So I think it's really smart to have those extra jurors.
Today in the jury selection, there was something that I really haven't heard that much of, and that was basically people coming in and saying, oh, yeah, he's guilty. And it's like, well, thank you very much for showing up. I mean, you appreciate the honesty, but this is also part of the problem that they have with this, you know, trying to seat this jury, is that there are a lot of people, because of the nature of the crime here. The reality is that I'm surprised they actually haven't had more of that.
You know what? You're right. And in fact, that scares me. I'm thinking about this on the defense side, but frankly, you should think about this on the prosecution side, is there are some people who want in. They want to be jurors. And so what they want to do, and maybe this is a human nature thing, people want to believe that they can be reasonable. We can't. I mean, frequently we can't. The thing is we believe what we believe. We think what we think. And in fact, I know people who are prosecutors and defense attorneys, too, because I've had a lot of friends of mine who do this work who said, yeah, you'd never want me on this jury for a whole series of reasons. And the problem is that some people think that they can withhold judgment, but they've already decided. And so I think the problem is not just to take at face value. And this is really the challenge when picking a jury. It's not to take at face value what people say, but the underlying motivating factors that drive them in their life. So, for instance, when somebody says, can you be fair? They'll say, of course I can be fair, because who's going to say they're not going to be fair? Some people might, but a lot of people will knee-jerk react and say, of course I can be fair. What I might do is I might turn to them and say, what is the underlying principle that you think should drive this case? And you ask them, there's going to be some people who will say, justice. Tell me about what justice means. Justice means somebody paying for the things that they did. Now tell me, if somebody says justice and paying for the things that they did, what does that mean? And you start pulling on the strings of that sweater, trying to understand what that means. And you may come to realize that, in fact, those people, even if they haven't acknowledged it to themselves, that they know that this guy is guilty, that they made the decision in their own head, even though they want to hold back, but they've made that decision. So it's about driving them to acknowledge. Maybe it's driving them to realize where their answers are and what those answers mean. So it's far more about asking them what drives them than what they just think at the surface level, because frequently it is not the same thing.
And it's like you said, you show that tape once again, even if you are trying to bury that down and try, then you remind everyone, let's remind everyone why we're here. And you show them that tape, and that brings it all right back to the surface.
Well, it does. And I think you realize the challenge. I remember I was in Tbilisi in the Republic of Georgia teaching jury selection. This was a country that had just started. This is just a couple of years ago. They had. This is after the Iron Curtain fell, after the fall of Soviets, but long after the implosion of the Soviet Union and even the Commonwealth part of with the Russians and the rest. And I was teaching jury selection to lawyers because they were trying to understand what that meant. And it's really difficult when you start thinking about all of the various things that drive people to think the things that they do. So sometimes you may have people there who are driven by the village that they're from, and their village elders may say, this is what you think. And you would go, oh, well, yeah, that's just not part of the developing world. And my response to that is, really, let's find out if somebody, and you can't ask this, but this is something you might want to know. If I were a Republican, what would a Republican think about this? Well, I don't know. Is that that much more sophisticated, or is it maybe less sophisticated? You might think that there may be political biases that will defer to power in ways that other biases won't. And so you have to think about what that means. And there are some who will absolutely, under all circumstances, defer to power. They just do. And sometimes it's because they depend upon it so much in their own lives, because that's what keeps them where they are. That's how they sit. And frequently, I think that's a big part of it. A lot of people desperately want to believe that the police are the good guys. Well, what happens if there's police on both sides? And the ones who are saying they're the good guys, meaning the prosecution, this unit, is saying the other guy's the bad guy. Oh, I see. So we're the good guys. He's the bad guy. Really? It's just a broader question you have to get into with people and not be afraid. You have to be willing to listen to them and say, I'm really not judging. I'm just trying to understand. Because you don't know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. And you have to let them find their way. Sometimes people try to force it. I've seen judges try to force it when they'll literally say, if I order you to be fair, will you be? That's like saying, if I order you to say you like chocolate ice cream, will you say it?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
I like chocolate ice cream. How's that?
Exactly.
Oh, by the way, I do like
chocolate. Well.
And vanilla and strawberry and Rocky Road and praline.
Butter Brickle is delicious. I mean, have you tried it?
Fantastic.
is there any chance you think there might be? I mean, I know you, the twists and turns and back and forths, but we get the jury set up. You have said in the past with court cases that don't be surprised if between the jury selection and the beginning of the trial that there's a plea agreement that's reached. Do you think that there, in this case, there would be one that's come to grips? Because we know about the one that was apparently hanging out there with the former Attorney General Barr.
You know, here's the thing, is that one of the things that can do this is when you look at what can happen to you if you don't resolve a case. In a case like this, that second-degree charge and even the third-degree charge have presumptive 150-month commits. Okay, so that's about 12 and a half years. That's what the guidelines say. But because of special circumstances in this case, and because this guy's a cop, and because of what he did, and the infamy of it, and sort of all that, I'm expecting the prosecutor to go for a double upward if they can get a conviction on this. So in other words, you're looking at 25 years. So that in itself drives a lot of what this could do. If because of that, I think that there is still a very real chance that you may get an agreement here. And that agreement would be, I'm still looking, it won't be the second degree charge. They'll never give him the manslaughter charge because it's a presumptive 48 months to serve. With good time, you pull a third of that off. So now all of a sudden you're at like 2.5 years, the city would explode. I wish it wouldn't, but I got a bad feeling it would under those circumstances. Prosecutors can't do that politically, which means it only leaves that third degree charge. And that third degree charge, which they really fought for, with that agreement for that 10-year mark, he's out in about six years and 6 months. I mean, he's relatively young. These are all calculations that are being made right now. you could find a resolution in that range right there.
I don't know if you caught the changing subjects. Last thing for you here. Changing subjects, 60 Minutes last night. Interesting discussion about the January 6th terrorists that attacked the Capitol. And a lot of people have been focusing on the fact that they haven't charged anyone with sedition yet. But the FBI made a very, imagine sobering statement for the traitors, which is we have just with the 400, you have multiple charges that are federal charges that are 5-year terms, 10-year terms, 20-year terms. That's before assaulting federal law enforcement. And that's before possibly the death of Sicknick. You have, I mean, what they're putting forward is this. The people that did storm that Capitol, they're going to go away for a while.
This is federal.
Yes.
Here's the difference between state law and federal law frequently, is there are mandatory minimum sentences. And so what you have is the ability to make an argument, especially in some of these cases, where it was a coordinated effort by multiple people. And when you get that coordination, what you have is the potential to charge everybody who touched it with what everybody else did. You then start stacking that kind of stuff on top of each other, and you start talking about the physical assault, the really serious bodily injury, and then ultimately the death. You have those pieces all together. The potential is to see the inside of a federal prison for a very, very long time. And so we have a lot of pressure by the feds in this case to get people to roll and acknowledge their own guilt out of fear, because a lot of what the feds can do is they have these draconian sentences. And so people are really afraid to go to trial, because even if they have a chance of winning, the possibility of losing is so horrific that they're frequently unwilling to roll those dice. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't, and frequently they won't, because they know how bad it can be.
Yeah, the thought of that, some of these people that really do think that for some reason they're going to get let go, that they could go to jail for 20, 30 years. I mean, it is, yeah, that was an interesting angle. And I imagine there's a lot of people that were storming the Capitol on January 6th that are realizing that they now have made a massive mistake. JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com. I'll link to that. If you need a defense lawyer, Jack is your guy. Talk to him by all means. Jack, thank you very much. An absolute privilege to have you on once again.
Always, my friend. Always.